Welcome to Gay USA. I'm Andy Hum.
I'm Ann Northrup.
And we're going to start on the news on a very, very somber note this week. We just learned of the death this morning of Larry Kramer, an incomparable activist. He catalyzed the AIDS movement with GMHC and ACT UP. And he also shone as a screenwriter and playwright. He has died at 84.
A good friend to both of us, and we will talk about his accomplishments and his life and our memories of him. But first, we're going to talk to our primary substitute co-host on Gay USA, Chris Cooper, who is, yes, the person who had the confrontation with the racist white woman in Central Park this week. And imagine our surprise to wake up yesterday and hear that our Chris Cooper was the man involved. And so he is joining us live from home at the top of the show.
And as we pass 100,000 dead in the United States from COVID-19, Dr. Deborah Birx, who now shills for Trump, is criticized for her AIDS work by the State Department's Inspector General.
Which will remind us why we used to have inspectors general. Nita Pippins, a Southern mom who became a mother to many gay men with AIDS in New York after it took her son in 1990, has died of COVID-19.
Same-sex marriages got underway in Costa Rica.
And France has elected its first transgender mayor.
The gay-themed movie God's Own Country was censored to make more money, but the director got the sex scenes restored. And speaking of sex...
And our guest for the last 15 minutes of the show is veteran TV producer and documentarian Joe Lovett. He's going to talk to us about his brilliant documentary, Gay Sex in the 70s, because it's going to be made available free for 24 hours online on June 1st. And he'll talk about how he produced the first network news magazine pieces on AIDS. But we start, we'll start with Chris Cooper. Do we have Chris Cooper available and joining us? Chris, come on down.
Now?
We usually don't get a chance to talk to Chris or have him on the show at this time of year, because he's bird watching. But Chris, welcome. Everyone here has known you for many years as the substitute, primary substitute co-host for Gay USA. And we really were shocked to wake up yesterday morning, as we're taping on Wednesday, and hear Chris Cooper in Central Park, bird watcher, confrontation with racist white woman.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a surprise to me that it took that turn. Not the part about a confrontation with the dog walker. That's almost routine in Central Park for us birders. But the fact that it took that sudden racist dive was a bit of a surprise for me as well.
Well, let me start by asking how you are, because you suddenly, in a matter of moments, turned into a worldwide phenomenon. God knows when it's going to end, but how is this affecting you personally at the moment?
You know, it's stressful a bit. You know, it's a lot of people trying to make various demands. And, you know, this one wants an interview and this one wants you to do this. You know, that's kind of stressful. Which makes me realize if that's what I'm getting, oh my God, what she must be getting. You know, it must be a tsunami heading her way. Her being the woman who was walking her dog off leash in the Ramble. So,
Who also happens to be named Cooper, Amy Cooper. But talk about just for you know, just take a moment to just tell us how it unfolded.
Sure. New York City, to give you just the setting, New York City sits on the Atlantic Flyway, which means that migratory songbirds coming back from their wintering grounds funnel up the coast, and they hit the metropolitan area, which is a sea of concrete, and smack in the middle of Manhattan is this beautiful emerald green rectangle where there's water and where there's growing things and where they can rest and refuel on their journey so that they can actually make it alive. and that's Central Park. And so Central Park aggregates the birds. They funnel in there, and it's a top birding destination. People come from all over the world to bird Central Park during migration. So one of the things that makes Central Park so special is there's an area, several areas that are very productive for the wildlife. They are planted. They have things that grow there. They have waterways. And one of those, one of the most famous, is the Ramble. Now, of course, the Ramble is also notoriously, at least in ages past, one of the areas where gay men used to hook up before we could be out and hook up legitimately. So, but
that had Grindr.
Yeah, exactly. Pre-Grindr, there was the Ramble.
Right. Or as your sister calls it, the Bramble.
Yeah. I know. I was like, no, it's the Ramble. You got it wrong. So anyway, a Ramble is a top birding spot, and because it is such a sensitive area, because there are so many things, there's so many incredible plantings there, and because there's so much wildlife there, and because it is such critical habitat for migrating birds, there is a rule that dogs must be on the leash at all times in the Ramble to protect the wildlife, to protect the habitat. It's posted on signs everywhere. So here I am in the Ramble, and this is an ongoing thing. Like I said, this goes back years that we have been fighting for enforcement of the leash laws in the Ramble. But here comes, you know, a young woman, and her dog is off the leash and tearing through the plantings. So I say to her, you know, excuse me, ma'am, dogs in the Ramble have to be on the leash at all times. You're standing right next to the sign that says that. And she says, oh, yeah, but, you know, the dog runs are closed, and he needs his exercise. And I'm like, I get that, but all you have to do is take the dog over the drive to the area that's outside the Ramble in Central Park, and you can let your dog run off the leash until 9 a.m. to your heart's content. And she's like, oh, no, that's too dangerous. And I'm like, so at this point, you know, basically things devolved from there. I'll give you the short version. When it became clear that she, you know, wasn't interested in complying, I decided to videotape her scofflaw behavior, which is something a lot of us in the Ramble have been trying to do when we encounter an intransigent dog walker who, you know, won't put their dog in the leash in the Ramble. Just so we document it and we can try and get some change. So I pulled out my cell phone and I started recording. She didn't like that. So she said, you know, please stop recording me. And I had no intention of stopping recording her until she put the dog on the leash. She didn't like that. She started to come at me and I'm like, you know, I didn't say this. I'm thinking we're supposed to be social distancing right now. So I said, please don't come near me. Please don't come near me. And finally she said her famous line, and this is where, you know, up until then it was just a conflict between a dog walker and a bird watcher. And here's where she took it to a dark place, when she said, if you don't stop recording me, I'm going to call the police and I'm going to tell them that an African-American man is threatening my life. And I'm like, oh, boy. So what do I do now? Because, you know, the implications for me are clear. You know, we've seen far too many instances, far too many tragedies, far too many videotapes. And I just thought, I'm not going to capitulate to this. She's playing the race card. I'm not going to be racially intimidated. I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. You know, as if race wasn't a factor here. You know, I'm not going to participate in my own dehumanization. I'm just not going to do it. So I kept videotaping, or recording with my iPhone. And she, you know, made the phone call to the police. And that's, you know, you see all of that in the infamous now video that's gone viral. So, you know, and then finally she puts, after slinging the dog around by the collar for a couple of seconds, which was really kind of unnerving, she finally puts the dog on the leash. And I said, thank you, and turned off the iPhone and went back to birding.
Now, what we don't see on the video, And can I ask you to adjust your screen a little? We're not seeing the top of your head. Just there we go. Thank you. We don't see what happened when the police arrived.
And I don't know what happened when the police arrived, because she couldn't tell them where in the Ramble she was. Admittedly, you know, Ramble geography, it's called the Ramble for a reason. It's a number of winding paths that go every which way. We birders have been birding it for, you know, since the dawn of time, so we know our way around the ramble, but she didn't know where in the ramble she was and couldn't describe it. So, you know, the police were asking her where she was in the ramble, and she said, "I don't know where I am." So anyway, as far as I was concerned, the episode was finished as soon as the dog went on the leash. That was what was my concern. And I went back to birding as usual. And I, you know, had in the back of my head, okay, well, the police may be on their way. And, you know, if and when they come, I will deal with that. But in the meantime, I came here to bird. So that's what I'm going to do.
But we know what's happened to African-American men forever, and including very recently, including, you know, this week a couple of times, et cetera. Were you fearful for your life?
Was I fearful for my life? I don't know if I thought it through that far. I was nervous. I was a little bit rattled, I guess, by what had happened, even though, you know, I try to make it like I'm a Vulcan from Star Trek and nothing can emotionally rattle me. I was a little rattled by the whole thing. But, one of the wonderful things about birding and about being in a place like the Ramble in Central Park is that it's got this wonderful calming effect. It's like a tranquilizer. So, you know, I just sort of focused on my birding, and before I knew it, I was basically wrapping up my birding anyway at that point. So I just focused on my birding, chilled out, and then, you know, left the park and left her to whatever she was going to do.
And then the world exploded. We should also mention that you are one of the main characters in the documentary about Central Park birders that ran on HBO, and I'm sure that people can still find that. So,
a board member of the Audubon Society, and you have a long history in
the Audubon.
New York City Audubon, and you were a co-chair of GLAAD when it was still an activist group back in the day.
Yeah, before it became an award ceremony promoter, this was back when GLAAD was still a New York-based organization before it sort of metastasized into, you know, it was in the process of becoming, you know, it was national, but it wasn't, you know, national with chapters and all of that. It was still a New York-based grassroots organization.
Now, and you've also been very involved in local politics and promoting particular candidates, mostly LGBT candidates, but all candidates, progressive candidates over the years.
And getting rid of Republicans in the New York State Legislature.
I was gonna say, and you're not quite getting it right. My goal in life was to flip the New York State Senate.
You did it.
Yeah, and that wasn't necessarily about promoting, though I would love to promote progressive candidates and LGBTQ candidates, it was about promoting Democratic candidates who could then push out the Republican majority. And it took a long time, but we did it. I think, wasn't it UN who said, like, last week the quote that activism is a long haul or something
yes.
like that?
Well, it is, and we're now on that haul nationally.
Now, what happened to this woman is she became infamous, and she was fired from her job at Franklin Pendleton. She tried to apologize. You said you would accept the apology if it was sincere, and she kept her dog on a leash.
Well, you gotta understand where I'm coming from on all of this. For me, the whole thing was about getting the damn dog on a leash. That's what it's about. It's been a problem with us for years. Then she took it someplace else. And that's on her. And she's unfortunately suffering the consequences for it. I say unfortunately just because, her life went from, normal to collapsed in about 60 seconds.
Yeah.
And that's a hard, hard thing. I can't begin to imagine, you know, and for a lapse in judgment, a profound lapse in judgment that was a racist act. Let's not
because it could have been worse for you.
It could have been. We don't know that it would have. So, you know, so I don't like to speculate that, oh, this is what would have happened. It could have been worse. It wasn't. And so, you know, since it wasn't, I'm not sure. I have very mixed feelings about the aftermath for her in particular. You know, if what's happened has been proportional.
Well, I think I would agree with you that that's a conundrum, and I feel some ambivalence about that too. But every time I start to feel ambivalence, I see that tape again, and I realize how deliberately she tried to set you up for an arrest by the police at best, and very possibly worse. And the deliberation that she went through to make that statement and that accusation is so infuriating to me and so scary that I lose a lot of sympathy for her when I remember just how manipulative and racist and deliberate that act was.
Especially when we see what happened to people like George Floyd this week and in Minnesota. And you talked about Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia and what happened to him when he was just jogging through the street.
Right. I'm trying to look at this beyond her in the individual instance and look at the deeper undercurrent and how do we address that? Because that deeper undercurrent is what causes things like the death of Ahmaud Arbery and the death of George Floyd. You know, and it's been going on for centuries, and it runs through this entire country and runs through this city, which so many people seem to be surprised about. They're like, wow, that this can happen in New York City. I'm like, where have you been? Did you not pay attention when Eric Garner got choked to death on Staten Island? You know, Were you not paying attention when Amadou Diallo got blown away on his own doorstep? So, you know, that's what I want to focus on because, you know, her split second, extremely poor judgment that led her to a racist place. You know, she's paying the consequences for that. How do we start to address the underlying issue that led her there, that leads to all these deaths and all these problems? I think that's where the focus should be. And you know, I can't get inside her head. I don't know what she was thinking, but I imagine she was trying to get a leg up in the confrontation because it was definitely a confrontation. And anybody in a confrontation is going to try to get an advantage. And the problem was where she went to get that advantage was a racist place, whether she realized it consciously or not. And it's had consequences for her.
And a very, very dangerous place. Racist, absolutely horrifying, but the danger that she deliberately tried to put you in is unimaginable.
She reminded me of Mayella Yule in To Kill a Mockingbird pointing the finger at Tom Robinson and saying, you know, he raped me, basically. And people understand that.
So we don't want to take you back to that dark place, but we want to be clear that this was not an inconsequential act or something to be glossed over at all. This is very, very serious.
And we're glad to see you well.
What happens now, you know? And like I said, I'd like the focus to be on, you know, what can we do to address this underlying current that runs through this city and this country to try to amend that. And actually, I read something about how she's Canadian, which I'm like, seriously? A Canadian person went there like that? But I don't know if that's true or not. I don't have independent corroboration of the Canadian part.
Well.
We're very glad to see you. We're very glad that you're alive and well and proud of you as, of course, a member of the Gay USA family. Happy to ride your coattails of association.
and if there's anything we can do.
Can you make my life go back to normal?
Yeah.
You have to just put your head under the covers for a few days, and with any luck, it'll calm down. But you must have been totally assaulted by the news media. I can't even imagine how awful that's been for the last 24 hours.
Yeah, trying to get work done has been a little bit difficult, but,
And there's a pandemic going on.
I'm always happy to come and talk to you guys.
Good.
I just prefer not to be the news. I'd rather be talking about the news.
Well, you'll be back here soon co-hosting, and we look forward to that. And Really, thank you so much, Chris, and so much love and support for you, from us, from everybody we've heard from Gay USA viewers and fans of you. Everybody is out here pulling for you.
Thanks, guys.
Love you, Chris. Take care.
Bye.
Goodbye. See you soon. Okay. Now if we can get, there we go. Goodbye to Chris. And now, well, now we will talk about Larry. You know, we're preparing to do the show, getting organized with Chris and Joe Lovett, who you'll see later. And suddenly there's the news that Larry died.
Larry Kramer's name is probably the most known name to the general public in terms of, you know, gay AIDS activism for, you know, in history.
Yes. And, you know, I loved Larry. He was, a lot of people found him difficult. He was certainly cranky a lot of the time, but it's because he was angry about the world and he tried to do something about it and he was relentless about it.
You would always say, where is your anger? Given what we're going through, I mean, we're being slaughtered in this AIDS crisis, and he was pretty angry even before that. You know, I mean, one of the first time I became aware of him, this op-ed piece appears in the New York Times and it says, gays in New York don't deserve their rights. They're not working hard enough for them. They have it in San Francisco. What's wrong with you in New York? And I said, who is this guy? I never heard of him. I was an activist for 7 or 8 years by then, and we were working hard on it, and it's tough. And so when I finally met him, boy, oh boy. Of course, before that, before all this, he was famous as the screenwriter and producer of Women in Love, the movie in 1969. On the D.H. Lawrence novel, for which he was nominated for an Academy Award, won an Academy Award for Glenda Jackson, and then he was a movie producer, and he made...
Let's walk through some of that history chronologically. This, believe it or not, is Larry Kramer in 1957 at Yale. He was there in the midst of the gay witch hunts at Yale when the administration was targeting people thought to be gay, bringing them in, threatening them with expulsion if they didn't turn in other gay students, forcing them to go to psychotherapy. Larry says he attempted suicide at the time when he was at Yale. It was a really awful time there. But he survived that, and he went on to work in the movie industry. He was in London for a dozen years working as a production assistant. This is a little later, but leave that up there.
That's Larry, on Fire Island, where he found the inspiration to write Faggots.
Yeah. But before that, he acquired the rights to Women in Love, the D.H. Lawrence novel. He bought the rights for like $4,500 or something, and co-produced it and wrote the script and got nominated for an Oscar. He then did come back to New York. And he wrote in 1978 this novel, Faggots, that just got everybody angry all over again.
Now, you're skipping a step here.
Okay.
He also produced a movie called, because now he has an Academy Award nomination, he produces a musical of Lost Horizon.
Yes.
It was a terrible film, but he got paid a lot of money as the producer.
Yes.
And it gave him a lot of financial security. His brother, Arthur, invested that money. So that gave him a lot of freedom to do the things he wanted to do. And one of the things he wanted to do was to speak out on gay issues.
And so he wrote Faggots, and that just annoyed everyone in the gay male community, because this was 1978. People were getting sick and dying.
Wait a minute. We didn't know about that at the time.
We didn't know that what it was, and it wasn't until 1981 that it was written about. But people were getting sick and dying in the late 70s, and people knew something was going on. And Larry...
Okay, we can...
That is a large reason he was writing... Wait a second, you're getting ahead of us, Rich. Larry... like others, began to think that promiscuity was an issue. And he wrote about that in the book in negative ways, and people got very angry at him.
He was telling the gay secrets.
Yeah.
It was a badge of honor not to read the book in those days. And I debated him on the radio about it, having not read it. It was terrible. But, I mean, eventually you got to know him. Actually, the book Faggots, it's a picaresque novel. It's a kind of a comic novel.
I liked it.
You know, sure. Of course.
Yeah. Well, then, so yes, he became very outspoken in the community. And one thing that impresses me is that he did have this movie industry career. He was Lost Horizon as a musical may have been a bomb, but he was an Academy Award nominee, and he could have gone on to continue in the industry, but he didn't. He started writing these books and plays about the gay experience and gay life. And when HIV and AIDS became more visible and more of a political issue, he dove right in. And the fact that he was willing to walk away from his movie career, maybe not willingly, but he did, and into this political activism, I think was astonishingly admirable.
It was Larry Kramer in 1981, in August, when, you know, the first articles were written by Larry Mass in the New York Native about AIDS, which was, we didn't know what it was called or exactly what it was, in May of 1981. And then the CDC releases something in June, and something is written about it in the Times in July, but it's not a big story. And he calls everybody he knew to his home at 2 Fifth Avenue, right there on Washington Square, and to listen to Dr. Alvin Friedman Kine talk about this new phenomenon. It was scary as hell. And that gathering led to the founding of the Gay Men's Health Crisis. And Larry hoped that was going to be a big activist group. It turned into a service group led by his friend Roger McFarlane. He fell out with GMHC because he wanted it to be more activist. When they finally got a meeting with Ed Koch, he was excluded, the mayor, he was excluded from it. And so he had a falling out. And should we skip up to 1987?
No, a little before then. And by the way, I remember standing with Larry outside a GMHC big fundraiser. We were handing out anti-GMHC leaflets to the people going in. That was fun.
Well, you go ahead. I'm sorry.
In 1985, before the founding of ACT UP, 2 years before the founding, he wrote The Normal Heart, which was about Mayor Koch and government inaction about the epidemic. It was an angry play and very successful at the time.
Joe Papp did it at the Public Theater. It was searing. I mean, it was drama about stuff that was happening right then. And if you were in the audience, you were looking at other people who were portrayed in the play. It was the highest use of theater. Very, very, very moving. And of course, it had a revival many years later on Broadway, and he won the Tony for it.
Yes, and was made into a movie for HBO. You know, the 2011 revival. That's when it really hit me. I had seen, if not the original production, another revival. I'd seen it somewhere along the line and admired it. But in 2011, for some reason, it really, really hit me terribly emotionally. It was a wonderful play, and I hope will be revived a lot.
Of course, he was always after the government, and that's why he was one of the founders of ACT UP. ACT UP was founded after a speech that he gave in March of 1987 at the community center.
Now, there had been...
I just want to say about that.
Yeah.
What he did that night, he took over the speaking slot at the center from Nora Ephron, who was sick, and he called everybody he knew, and he said, I gotta come to the center. I said, Larry, I heard you speak last week in a Senate visit. And he said, you just effing be there. Hung up the phone. And he did that to everybody. So we're all sitting there. What's he going to say? What's he going to say? And he was so angry that we have, where is your anger? He would say to us, why aren't you doing more? And that's what led to ACT UP.
One of his well-known quotes, and I'm not sure whether this comes out of that speech or something else, unless we fight for our lives, we shall die. And he famously said, you know, half the room stand up and the other half you'll be dead. But it would not be appropriate to give him full credit for founding ACT UP. First of all, there were people like the Lavender Hill mob who were working on AIDS issues and government inaction before that. And they were a smaller...
Our associate producer, Bill Ballman.
Right. They were a smaller
Harry
group.
Robinson.
But certainly very active and involved. And there's been fighting over the years about, you know, who's responsible for starting AIDS activism. But Larry was a catalyst, a crucial catalyst at that time in 1987 when ACT UP was founded. Because, as you say, he lit the rocket and it took off.
And he was furious, not just at government. We can talk about that. Ronald Reagan, Mayor Koch, Governor Cuomo. And he was furious at them, but also mainstream television wouldn't cover it. We're going to have Joe Lovett later to talk about that. But the New York Times, the premier newspaper, would not cover AIDS. They did a little story in 1981 and then nothing for a couple of years, actually until Joe Lovett's piece came along in 1983. So, and he would call these editors and publishers and scream at them.
He was fearless and relentless about all of this. The irony, of course, was that in person, he was a very sweet guy.
He was a pussycat.
Shy.
Why are people afraid of me, he would say.
Well, let's move on to the next photo. For many years, he was in love with David Webster. And I guess they'd been together a little early and then split.
Well, he'd been together with David, and some of that is portrayed in Faggots, and that, you know, that didn't work out at the time. And then they reconnected later in life and became quite the couple.
And married in 1994. Well, no, that's not possible. They got together in 94.
No, much later, and it was several years ago. They married in 2013.
But they've been together since 94, and David survives him, was a wonderful, loving partner all those years.
Space architect.
Yes, and they had Larry's place still at 2 Fifth Avenue, and then David's house in Connecticut. And let's show the last picture. Larry has been sick for a while, and it is both shocking to lose him, but not a surprise. He was 84. This was one of his last appearances at the New York Public Library. And after he finished speaking, I went over to him just to say hi and give him a kiss. And he said, did I make you angry? I said, no. And he was slightly disappointed, but amused.
Well, you know, his big theme at the end of his life, well, for a long time, was we have failed. He gave the speech at the Queer Liberation March, and it was all about, we have failed. We are not accomplishing what we need to accomplish. What are you doing? You're going to the beach. You're doing whatever you're doing. We need to all focus on. And yes, I mean, look what's happening in this country over Trump and everything else. And that was his theme. And when he spoke at the library, I just tried to help him along and say, well, Larry, would it have made any difference if you had never lived? And he goes, that's a stupid question. I mean, he didn't want to be distracted from getting us to deal with the fact that we were not succeeding the way we need to.
And he didn't want to be distracted from writing his major two-volume history of
the American people.
Yes, two volumes, about 800 pages each, talking about the untalked about homosexuality of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and gay people throughout history. And he just would not give up any of that. And what was I going to say? Now I've lost my train of thought. The thing about Larry was, as he would often say, he was, as Andy says, furious at gay people for not doing more on our own behalf. But he also said in the same breath, I love my gay people.
Yes.
Constantly.
Except Ed Koch. when Koch was the speaker at an AIDS walk, and Larry is the only protester up there standing in front of the entire assemblage holding a sign saying, Koch, the worst. And the GMHC people were too afraid to have the police move in on him. And he was able to protest.
And I remember him prominently carrying the Koch, I'm a heterosexual, and the other half of the sign says, and I'm Marilyn Monroe.
Wait, there's more. Koch moved into his building after his mayoralty in 1989, and the board of the building said, "Larry, you can't speak to the mayor anymore. It's too upsetting everybody." So he said, "All right." So when he would see Koch, he would look at his dog and say, "Molly, that's the man who killed all of Daddy's friends."
So it is, it's sad and shocking. I've talked to several people already today who are in tears over this. Although, as I say, it's not a surprise at this point, but people are feeling an enormous loss.
Hey folks, up to us to carry on his work.
He was unique, truly unique, but he must be followed by everyone else with the same dedication to the work that must be done.
I loved Larry.
Very much.
Still do.
Yep. So goodbye to Larry for the moment. I'm sure we'll continue with more of this next week. We've just heard about this, as we said. But
let's talk about some of the people we're mad at.
Okay.
Dr. Deborah Birx.
Ah, the worst.
Well, I mean, you've seen her on TV. She's become a shill for Trump, covering for all of his lies and stupidity. But this week, we learned through Truth Wins Out. Is that the name of the group?
Yes. Wayne Basson's Truth Wins Out uncovered a February report from the State Department Inspector General, Linick, the guy who was just fired.
Because he was going after Pompeo.
Yes. Well, it turns out he did a massive report on Dr. Birx and found that her AIDS colleagues, when she was running AIDS operations for the government, dictatorial, autocratic, poor communication, low morale in working with her, lack of collaboration and trust.
She would fly hundreds of people around the world to ceremonies where she was being honored to augment the crowd at the expense of the mission of the AIDS unit there.
Abusive, narcissistic, power tripping, and her unrealistic performance goals led to her staff having poor morale and lying and falsifying results to satisfy her.
And it said she doesn't listen to experts on the ground. I don't know why this story has not gotten more traction.
Absolutely. Thank you to Wayne for exposing this, and watch out for Deborah Birx, who is clearly fudging results to make up for Trump stuff and stay in his good graces.
Speaking of results, we're finally getting the City Department of Health to ask people being tested for COVID about their sexual orientation and gender identity. That is due to activism. It's the law, but they weren't fulfilling it. So you will fill out a survey if you want to get a free test.
Wow. Well, meanwhile, we've lost 100,000 people as of this week. And the New York Times devoted its front page and a couple of pages inside to listing the names of just 1,000 of them.
That was so profoundly moving to see that. The United States now has 28% of the deaths from COVID in the world. And we only are 4.3% of the population of the world. This is an absolute catastrophe here.
And these losses are also being personified by the actions being done by Rise and Resist and others with these body bags that they are taking. They took some to the White House last week. This is in front of the Trump International Hotel in New York City.
Columbus Circle says, "Trump lies, people die, 100,000 dead." Right there. They took that all over town.
Yep, and farther, I hope.
And they wouldn't be able to do this if we hadn't won a victory for the First Amendment this week with the New York Civil Liberties Union, with Norman Siegel, with Reclaim.
Chris Dunn of the New York Civil Liberties Union went to court suing the governor and I think the mayor, the governor at least, about their First Amendment destroying executive orders that said churches can open. And what was the other one?
With 10 people, Memorial Day celebrate observances.
Memorial Day, yes.
But he said that's content discrimination. If 10 people want to gather healthfully spaced, wearing masks, what's the problem? And the governor caved.
Next up, Ann Northrup and Reverend Billy answer their summons at court over First Amendment gathering issues in August.
Okay.
It's still on. All right. What else here? Nita Pippins. Nita Pippins.
Okay. Oh, yes, of course.
87 years old. Died of COVID-19. She had come to New York from Florida in 1987 to take care of her gay son who had AIDS. She hated New York. But
she happy about him being gay either.
Yeah. She stuck around. He died, Nick, 3 years later in 1990. And she stayed in New York because she saw that all these young men with AIDS were being rejected by their families. And she became a surrogate mother to hundreds of them.
She would meet them at the airport, at the bus station.
The families.
She came from a conservative, yes, she came from a conservative background. They could relate to her. And she was just unbelievable.
She would reconnect these guys with their families. She worked a lot with Miracle House. And she has just died at 87. We're very sorry to lose her. Just a couple of things. The Parks Department for the East Meadow in Central Park, where the Samaritan's Purse tents were, they're now disinfecting it with pesticides. You know, we held a cleansing ceremony. They're using pesticides. They tore up the lawn like crazy. That's coming back. But they're making sure, I guess, that there's no COVID virus there. But that seems a little extreme. In South Lansing, Michigan, the cops have closed a gay club after they refused an order to shut down. In India, they're opening trans-specific quarantine centers, which actually is not a terrible idea if it allows people to be together and not mistreated.
We had a semi-victory at the Supreme Court. They're not going to put an Idaho trans inmate's gender confirmation surgery on hold while addressing the lawsuit moving forward. So the inmate can continue pre-surgical treatment and maybe even surgery.
The state is trying to stop it. So the court ruled against the state and in favor of the inmate in letting the surgery go ahead while this...
And we remind you to brace yourself for the Supreme Court decisions in the big gay and transgender cases. Another case, Gavin Brim's case, which went back to the lower courts, was heard again this week, but they basically said, well, whatever the Supreme Court decides on this issue of transgender being covered by sex discrimination will be covering our decision.
Rick Grenell has disappeared as Director of National Intelligence and as Ambassador to Germany. The Senate hated him so much that they agreed to put in this this Representative John Ratcliffe, who is a right-wing nutcase, as Director of National Intelligence. He'd been rejected before, but now he's in there to replace Grenell.
We're getting down to our last 15 minutes here.
Okay. Let's just see if there's anything else we need to do.
We can hold it. We can hold a lot of this stuff till next week.
Yes, we can. So let's do that. And let's bring in Joe Lovett. Do we have Joe Lovett available to come join us here? Oh, don't put up his phone number. Rich, get that off the screen. cover your eyes. You're not seeing this. Well, a couple of other notes while we're waiting for Joe to...
There'll be a lot of entertainment notes in our email.
Oh, there he is. He's sideways, but he's there. Can we reorient Joe on the screen? Other way. Joe.
There he is.
Yes. Okay, now can we hear Joe? I think you have to unmute yourself, Joe. No, not the phone number again. Well, meanwhile, I watched the Jane Roe TV movie.
Yes.
Well, it was heavily about her as a lesbian, which I think has not been talked about enough. And the real basis of the movie or the payoff was that she had allowed herself to be paid by the right wing to claim she was anti-abortion.
Right.
That was all a lie. This was a documentary, actually, and so it was really her. But it really talked about all her girlfriends, and starting very young as a teen, but she managed to get pregnant along the way. There's Joe. All right, so AKA Jane Roe I thought was worthwhile watching, but really worthwhile watching will be Joe Lovett's famous and brilliant documentary, Gay Sex in the 70s, which is legendary and is going to be available free for streaming next Monday, June 1st, for 24 hours all day long. And it's such an important documentary. So we wanted to talk to Joe about that and other things.
And the link will be in our email.
I think we can hear you now, Joe. Wait, you're going
on. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, oh. I can barely hear you.
Oh, interesting. Can you hear us now? Can you hear me talking to you?
I can hear you, but just barely, Anne.
Okay, can you turn up the volume on your computer? Is that a way to deal with it?
Yeah, I'm on my iPhone, and
I can see from your hand you're going to live a long life.
Let me say, Andy, I can't hear.
All right, well, we will continue to chat, and when you can hear us adequately for questions.
All right, let me try a different screen. Let me try a different computer.
Okay. We will move on as
all
you
right, sorry.
No problem. Andy, talk about God's Own Country and what happened with
God's
that.
God's Own Country was a great, great film out of England, directed by Francis Lee, about a gay farm guy, and he has an affair with a farm hand from Romania in the outside of in the countryside of England, and it was a terrific film, and it was on Amazon Prime, and they cut two of the big sex scenes, and the director Francis was furious. But it turns out it wasn't Amazon Prime that did it; it was the Goldwyn Company, who thought if we cut these scenes, this film will get more circulation, it will be more recommended on their carousels, blah blah blah. And the director wouldn't stand for it. He said, "You got to put the film back on as it is, or forget it." So sex triumphed.
The scenes have been restored, and Joe Lovett has been restored, looking much, much better on that screen. And I think you can hear us now, Joe.
Yes, beautifully. Thank you.
So Joe is a fabulous producer who worked for many years for CBS and ABC, for 2020, for producing the earliest network reports on AIDS and on gay people, and tell us about how Larry Kramer figured into that, Joe.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I got to say the news of Larry's death was shocking and devastating. I mean, considering how sick he's been for so long, I can't believe I was so shocked. But I just thought he'd live forever. I really did.
Yeah.
Larry was, I always refer to Larry as our Jeremiah crying in the wilderness. You know, if it hadn't been for Larry, I think the response to AIDS would have been a good year, if not more, coming. Larry and I lived kitty corner to each other in the village, and he would knock on my door at the beginning of the epidemic, and he would say, "Why aren't you guys doing something at 2020?" And at that time, it was we thought of it mostly as a New York epidemic, and a little bit in San Francisco, and I said, "Well, you know, it's a local. I'll present it, but it's a local story." And then, as things raged on, I would go back to my producer meetings and saying, you know, let's do this. People would say, well, it's not our audience. You know, do we really want to talk about these things, et cetera, et cetera. And it was pretty discouraging. And I'd get home and then Larry would be at my door banging, screaming, "Why the fuck aren't you doing something?" And get back in there. And he literally did this once a week right after the producer meetings, if not more. And it was his pushing me that made me able to push the administration at 2020 to let us try to handle this.
And if you quote Larry again, you'll have to say effing because it's
right.
So let's move on to Gay Sex in the 70s. Your documentary from what year again?
I think we released it in 2005.
And we should just say up front, it's going to be available for streaming on June the 1st. Can you give them any information about that, where to go, or
it'll
be in our email?
Yeah, it's free for the day, for 24 hours on June 1st. And it only, you stream it for only It's only like $3.99 or something anyway. But it's free then. And then you just go to gaysexintheseventies.com and it'll tell you how to get there.
Okay. Now, I think of this documentary as being so fundamentally important because it captured a very particular point in history. Yes. After Stonewall, when gay men felt so much freer, and pre-AIDS, when suddenly the hammer came down.
Exactly. So, it was 12 years of unbridled sexual freedom. I had done so much on AIDS for 2020, and I did this when I'd opened up my own company, and I wanted to capture the joy of sexual expression, and I wanted to remember those 12 years for the extraordinary things that it did for the gay community in terms of establishing a gay sexual identity that that Roger McFarlane in the film discusses so beautifully, having taken away shame.
Yeah, we do have a picture of Roger there. I don't know if that can be pulled up, who was also the head of GMHC. There he is.
Yeah, wonderful guy.
And best friend of Larry's for a long time.
A partner of Larry's at one time.
That's right.
But talk about the impact of the documentary, and you've mentioned how reactions to it have changed over the years as you show it to your younger people.
Well, it's interesting. You know, when I first started to research it, to put it together, a lot of people in the gay community did not want it done. This was late 82, early 83. And, you know, they were afraid that it would take away sexual freedoms that had been won. And, but I, you know, people have said, I think you've said this, Andy, that after we did a series of them, but after the first one aired, that, that things were different, that people took a very somber tone and were more aware of the hideousness of this terrible disease.
Right, you're talking about your 1983 piece. We do have a picture there of Kenny
Ramsauer.
Oh, right, Kenny Ramsauer, who was a very good-looking guy. We have a picture of him there. And look, if we can bring that up, Rich.
We're jumping around a little for Rich.
There he is when he was young.
Kenny well, Kenny healthy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you put this picture up on the screen of him affected by AIDS and by Kaposi's sarcoma and other things.
Right.
That's the same guy.
Within
I'm
months.
In the room with about 20 games. We gasped. People gasped. In that picture, for those of us who didn't know someone who was being so affected by this, really changed everything.
Yeah.
And of course, you also, with this piece, you forced the New York Times to finally cover it.
Right. Well, covered on the front page. Yeah. No, what was the weird thing is that Geraldo was the correspondent and he was wonderful. And,
were the days.
Those were the days. And he said, so we said, the New York Times has not even put AIDS on its front page, despite the numbers in our city. Yet they put a herpes epidemic among Lipizzaner horses in Austria on the front page.
I remember that story.
And the next week, they put the AIDS story in exactly that box. Yes,
exactly.
Someone had a sense of irony.
Exactly. And you featured Dr. Fauci in the piece as well.
Yep. He was at NIAID, and he was a young man at the time, and he was the doctor of a young man who was part of a twins experiment, and he's a little bit older now. He looks the same, just a little grayer.
He does. And it is ironic for those of us who knew him in those days and went through our various battles with him to get NIH and NIAID to accelerate drug development, to see him now is sort of ironic.
Anyway, that was historic, groundbreaking, so important. You really broke the dam on coverage with that piece in 1983 on 2020. But let's talk a little bit more about gay sex in the 70s and why you thought it was so important to do.
Well, I had done an interview. Barton Benish, the artist, was one of my best friends. And I had was over at his house one Sunday morning, and I had my camera with me. It was just in my pocket, just a little camera, And we started talking about those times, And Barton was a great interview. And I just pulled out my camera and I started shooting. And when I got back to the office the next day, I had a lot of young people working for me, men and women, gay and straight. And I said, would you mind taking a look at this interview that I did yesterday? Let me just tell me how it's, if it speaks to you. You know, these are kids who are 20 years, at least 20 years younger than I. And they were shocked. They had, I mean, gay and straight alike, they had no idea of the shenanigans that were going on, you know, in our youth.
And it had a pretty good time.
Had a pretty good time. And they were stunned and they wanted to know more. And I was so shocked that they had no idea that, you know, that our reference points were so different that I decided to make the film. And I did it with the people that I knew. It was a pretty simple film. Sean Kaminsky was my co-producer on it. And we just went out and shot my friends, you know, Larry, Tom Bianchi, Larry Mass, Arnie Kantrowitz,
Roger,
of course, Bob Alvarez. Yeah,
these are guys who would mostly be in their 70s now. Yes,
in their 70s today. Yeah, for the most part. Yeah,
and you have their younger pictures, and you say, "Wow."
Yeah, well, that's an interesting thing because when I started to put it together, I thought young people don't want to watch these old guys talking. So that's why I started with their pictures when they were young and then dissolved into them later. You know, so it was, I think people had a sense of their youth.
And you talk about in the film the time when, you know, you were, you know, debating, could we still go on with the way we were living? You were on Fire Island, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was crazy. Anyway, it's crazy because people were wondering, you know, how, you know, with the outbreaks of sexual diseases, I think Ken Unger talks about this in the film, a doctor, you know, could this go on? And eventually, you know, the dam broke. But it's, go ahead.
Well, it just it strikes me that, you know, when you were in the middle of the 70s and experiencing this freedom,
yes,
you really had no ability to imagine that it would end and that something would happen. I remember, you know, I got into journalism after watching the Vietnam War and the glory that was open journalism then, the golden age. And little did I know that by the time I got there, it would all be gone and we'd have the retrograde attitudes that you ran into at ABC trying to produce this stuff.
Well, I wasn't the only one. I think everyone at the beginning had that kind of problem, even in print to some degree, but the print was less visual. I mean, like when we shot Kenny Ramsauer, you know, people said, that's so exploitive. How can you do that? And I said, he's the face of AIDS. If you don't show that, nobody's going to, it's not some thin young man, not just some thin young man in a hospital room. You know, it's transformative.
Down to our last minute, Joe, what else do you want people to know about this film?
Well, It's a great fun film, and younger people seem to see it very differently than people our age do. And it's very interesting what they feel that they've missed and what they feel. And one of those things is just a sense of community, is a sense of being together. And the film shows the wondrousness of that. And I think that's really important.